face the day his boy Dale won.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet, I mean clap your heads. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Racing Through History.
Hello, race fans. Welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. My name is Jeff Gilder. I'm going to try to guide you through the show. We still having a little bit of trouble getting Brother Tim and Brother Cody onto Skype. I don't know why, but we'll keep trying that. In the meantime, I'm going to turn this over to Coastal Jack and the Bopperini, and I'm going to go put the feed up on the website for you. So take it away, Bobby.
All right. Welcome to Racing Through History. We're also short of the Hewmaster, because
he's having another joint replaced.
He's the bionic man, or soon will be.
He's always going in joints. What kind of joints he into this time? Beer joint or juke joint?
No, he had his remaining knee replaced.
That's about the fourth knee he's had replaced, isn't it? In the fifth anniversary.
And boy, he's got more wives than joints than anybody does.
Maybe that's why he has to have all these joints replaced.
Yeah, it could be it.
So anyway, Hewlin, if you're listening,
we're going to give you crap as much as we can since you're not here.
Guaranteed.
So this is a racing show, though, nevertheless. So what is going on in the world of racing?
Well, Bobby, they had Talladega, but I didn't get to see it.
I got to see most of it. Up to the first big crash, I didn't see the last two, but the first really big one occurred. I believe it was with 17 laps remaining, but took out essentially half the field at least. I guess if you didn't see Talladega, it was kind of a typical Talladega type of race. I mean, anyone that survived stood a chance of winning, and I think at the end of the day, there were 8 cars on the lead lap and a total of 14 still on the speedway when the checkered flag flew. Can you confirm that, Jack, or that sounds like what you...
That sounds like what I heard. I didn't see the race. 14 cars on a 2.66-mile track must have looked...
And 6 of them was not on the lead lap.
Yeah.
6 of them was not on the lead lap.
It must have looked a little strange.
But on the plus side, they did have a good crowd. Or what looked, has Talladega removed stands? I mean, I'm asking. I don't know.
I don't remember. I don't think so. They always seem to have a good crowd. Daytona and Talladega.
Did they ever have stands on the backstretch at Talladega? Some of our panel probably knows. But they didn't now. They do not now because there were many shots where they would show, you know, going down the backstretch, and there's no stands there now. So there may never have been. I have a Danny Whitener says you want to really call it a race. Well, it was a playoff. It was a playoff race, which brings up a whole other subject. Should an open discussion? Should Talladega be a playoff chase race? should the chase even exist? But
well, that's a whole different story. I mean, I think they ought to split it up between the short tracks, the super speedways, and maybe throw a road course in there.
All right, Alex of Florida, he says that, yes, Talladega used to have backstretch stands, not a whole lot of seats. But, okay, so they have been removed because there's none there now. But still, in spite of all of that, it looked like a pretty good crowd. And I read today that the TV numbers was like 2.75, I think, which was a 35% increase. The last best numbers was 2.04 or something
like
that.
Now, what do you attribute that to, Bobby? Is it that everybody all of a sudden likes NASCAR because Dale Earnhardt Jr. is last time at Talladega?
Well, undoubtedly, the Dale Earnhardt Jr., the Earnhardt Talladega mystique, you know, was at full force this weekend, and all the for a lot of reasons and for a lot of years, Talladega has been Earnhardt country. You know, starting with Big E, won all those races there, and then Dale Jr.'s had success too, and it's just, you know, it's just the phenomena of Talladega is there's a lot of Earnhardt fans, and then he qualified on the pole this weekend, and they gave him the old Monte Carlo, and so they had a lot of promos going on, and it was all undoubtedly that played into some of it, wouldn't you think, that the Earnhardt phenomena?
Yeah,
you had to be pretty cool driving that old car around the track, didn't it?
And Jeff, you shed some more light on, you ran into someone where they did not agree that was his old car.
So you guys remember Rob Harville. He's been on the show with us. He worked, he's a television producer, and he worked for NASCAR Media for 10 years. And he was involved in a lot of the video presentations and media presentations with Hall of Fame inductees during that time. And he also worked on the Dale Earnhardt movie 3, and he worked on Dale Earnhardt's induction media for the Hall of Fame. And in the stuff that he presented to whoever it was he presents it to, he had in a picture of the Rod Osterlin number 2 car, and was promptly asked from the other people, why did you put that in there? He never drove that car. These are people either working for NASCAR or representing NASCAR. And he argued with them to no avail, and finally he just said the heck with it and took it out.
These were people that obviously only think he drove the black number 3.
That's it. That's all people know, man. You know, history. It's a strange thing, man. You gotta dig a little bit.
The Rod Osterlin car even predated, although it was the first example, the Wrangler Association.
Yep.
I think Wrangler came on like at the last race of 79, which was at California. Ontario
Vaguely,
Speedway. Because I remember they put the Wrangler emblems and stuff right on the car, because the color, that's really where the blue and yellow came from, was the Rod Osterlin car was blue and yellow to start with.
Yep.
And they put the Wrangler logos was yellow.
Yeah, who was driving for Rod Osterlin before that?
That's a good question.
Memory, come on.
Of us getting old around here. Yeah. Gosh, I can't remember either.
I want to say Joe Ruttman, but I think he drove after...
Yeah,
Earnhardt left the Rod Osterlin team. Well, it became the J.D. Stacy team. Remember, Rod Osterlin sold out when J.D. Stacy was buying everything in NASCAR. That was the first thing that he bought. And Earnhardt didn't stay very long after that. And Joe Ruttman did take over, but I don't remember who drove before then.
Is that where... Jake Elder worked for Osterlin, right?
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, the last race of the year, it was in 79, I think, when Wrangler came on board. If Dave Fulton was here, he would know all of this implicitly.
Yeah, I'm sure he would.
But anyway, they came on at Ontario and literally just put the stickers on the blue and yellow Monte Carlo.
So Neil Bonnet, Dave Marcus, Dave Pearson, Hut Strickland, Jimmy Spencer all drove for Osterlin. Let's see. Neil Bonnett in 77, Dave Marcus in 78, David Pearson in 79.
Well,
all leading up to the
and then Earnhardt 80. In 79 also.
Yeah, the champion won the champion. Earnhardt won a championship in 80.
In 80, but he drove at that car in 79 too.
Yeah.
Because he was rookie of the year in 79.
Yeah.
Primarily driving that car.
Yeah.
So
started his first team 79. He hired rookie Dale Earnhardt. Yeah, in 79.
Yeah, I think he might have won a cup Bristol in 79. I think Earnhardt won a race, or maybe two races in his rookie season. Dave, one of them was at Bristol.
Dave Marcus drove 30 races in 78.
For Osterlund.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Dale Earnhardt drove one race in 78 for Osterlund.
Really?
Yeah. According to the information I'm looking at right now, let's see what race that was. That was.
Because also in 78, Dale Earnhardt was running here at Myrtle Beach.
Yeah. That must have been Atlanta. I guess. Let me check this before I say that.
Still waiting for Cody and Tim.
Atlanta.
Which Atlanta? The spring race?
November 5th. Atlanta International Raceway of 78. Dale Earnhardt finished fourth, driving a number 98 for Rod Osterlund Enterprises.
So then that was probably
and
an old
Marcus
audition.
Was in the number two.
Yeah, it was a second car, a trial for his position in 79, so says Alex.
So Marcus was probably the driver prior to Earnhardt.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Remember there was a guy named Roland Wolodica that was like the team manager or
he drove some too.
What was it? Jake Elder told Earnhardt? Do you remember that?
I might, but I don't know.
He says, boys, you stick with me, you'll be wearing diamonds big as horse turds.
And bigger than that.
Yeah. I think I got that right. I don't know. Check me out. If you guys don't agree, chat it to us.
Yeah.
That Roland
Wolodica was
drove six races for.
But I think in the Earnhardt era, he was like a team manager. He wasn't a mechanic necessarily. He was like the overall. Wasn't Rod Osterlund from California or somewhere out west? Yeah. Something like that. And they never really had a sponsor back in those days.
San Jose, California. Born in 1934.
When Wrangler came along, that was sort of a big, a non-racing sponsor for that time.
Yep.
It was kind of unusual. And, of course, then Wrangler built that whole campaign around One Tough Customer, et cetera, et cetera, and stayed for a long time until the Earnhardt and Childress got Goodrich. That sort of shoved Wrangler out the door. Again, Dave Fulton could give us all the background.
Yep.
On how that all went together, but yeah, the blue and yellow Wrangler trademark that 100,000 street stocks have been painted to look like that.
Yeah.
A million.
Every Monte Carlo
that's ever been made looked like that at one time. That's where it all started.
Yep.
It was the car that the lady told you didn't exist, or told your friend that didn't. Yeah. Earnhardt never drove.
He never drove that car. He never drove a two car.
So we was originally at Talladega before we got sidetracked on all this Rod Osterlund.
Before we were digging up stuff from the past.
Yeah. So I'm still trying to get Tim and Cody on. Cody just texted me, and he's trying to load Skype, but it says I don't think Cody's updated Skype in 9 years.
It's about time.
Tim says he has the latest version, so I don't know what the issue is. I don't know. I do not know. Is Patrick Reynolds on chat?
Yeah, I thought I saw him earlier. Is he on
Patrick
here?
Get Patrick on here.
Patrick.
I do not see him now.
I'm going to ring his Skype number to see if he picks up. He's probably not sitting near his computer or got his headset out, but anyway.
Remember there was another guy like Rod Osterlund that came out of nowhere. Remember Warner W. Hodgson?
Oh, yeah.
Man, did he come strong.
He had some financial problems, if I remember correctly.
He must have had them all going in the right direction there for a while. Yep. He bought Rockingham and something else. Didn't he own another track? Or he owned he was a partner in Rockingham. And, the Warner W. Hodgson 500, he had all kind of stuff going on. He liked to sponsor Neil Bonnard a lot, it seems like.
And he was another California dude.
Yeah.
He was connected with the record industry, if I remember correctly.
I tell you what, from day one, NASCAR has always had an attraction for these kind of characters. Yeah. Somehow these people come out of seemingly obscurity and rise to extreme prominence.
A la J.D. Stacy.
Yeah. Yeah, J.D. Stacy. Carl Kiekhafer in the 50s done all that. And then they're just gone. In more recent times, remember Bobby Ginn? That ain't been long ago. Mark Martin drove for him for a little while. And they do these promos and the show on TV, and it always show they interview these entrepreneurs, and they all say how NASCAR just really, really fits in well with their marketing strategy of their various enterprises.
Alex says Warner Hodgson was a real estate magnet and failure.
Well, he had it going on there for a few years. Yeah. Now, I'd be dog if he didn't.
Let's emphasize that failure part. I think there was some bankruptcy and everything else involved.
Tim has given up on Skype. He says on chat, I've done everything I know how and can't get on.
Well, you can probably get one of them on the phone.
I can get one of them on the phone.
We can do that, then hang up and get the other one.
843-272-1900.
Otherwise, we'll have to guess what Tim would say.
Oh, we could do that.
We can do that.
That would be a lot of fun to guess what Tim would say.
Yeah. Well, what Danica do this week?
Didn't she get in a wreck at one point?
Danica.
No.
Maybe that was the race before that.
I'm sure Tim would have something to say about Danica.
He would, wouldn't he? Yeah. He loves her, man.
Oh, he does.
He wants to date her. Ricky Stenhouse Jr. got in a wreck, come to find out.
No way.
Yeah, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. Son. And Martin Truex Jr.
Goodness gracious.
Come to find out, they got in a wreck.
Goodness gracious.
Will wrecks never cease?
843-272-1900 is the number. Should you want to call in?
Cody? Tim?
We can try, Alex, but it won't even let me sign in. So what's the... Oh, they're talking about Skype, I guess.
We're talking about a regular telephone.
Yeah.
The Alexander Graham Bell invention.
It still works. It's amazing something that old works. You know, we were talking day before yesterday, about communication in general. You know, it hadn't been that long that all this technology just... happened.
Yeah.
You think back before the telegraph and radio and all that happened in the late 1800s. Then television came along, what, the 1920s or something? And that was it, man, until the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything stayed the same.
Then when, bless Al Gore's heart, man, when he gave us the internet.
Yeah.
How could he not be president and do something like that, you know? But think about that.
Yeah, he did it all by himself, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like to watch Perry Mason on MeTV, which is old-timey MeTV.
Picks up that phone.
Yeah, and they love to focus on telephones on Perry Mason.
Yeah.
Everybody, they call for a living.
Yeah.
And this old and Perry's got a intercom thing in his office, a big monstrosity. He sits on his desk with a receiver.
Yep.
It's so he can...
With them buttons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So think about this now. Out of all the communication mediums that there have been, the early ones didn't last. They were fads. You don't see people scratching stuff on rocks today, or smoke signals. I mean, that was a flash in the pan. It's out of here, you know. I mean,
technology that didn't hang.
It rooted it out. But here comes the telephone. It kind of rooted out the telegraph system, you know, and it's still here. We still use it.
There was a question on Jeopardy about a transportation system just recently, and the answer was, what is the Pony Express?
And nobody knew?
Yeah, somebody knew, but I didn't. I mean, I knew it, but I wouldn't. I mean, I didn't think. The question was what president sent the first message on this technology in whatever year it was, and it was the Pony Express.
Hmm. Was that 18...
64 or something like that.
Yeah, because that predated the telegraph. The telegraph put Pony Express out of business. That, and they wore out a bunch of horses in a short period of time.
Well, Tim is now signed out.
He's got mad and quit.
He quit. He's over. It's over. Well, it's he could have called in. He had the phone number there to call in. So, Cody, call us, 843-272-1900. I might have Cody's cell number here. I'll call him up. Let's see what he's got to say. Hope he don't give up, too. Man, these boys can't be giving up.
Yeah, they got to get this technology figured out.
Well, Jack, you had not the Carolina Race Place, but an inadvertent picture of a car that you and I know showed
Russell up Blackman car.
The Russell Blackman car.
Yeah, it was a picture I posted some time ago, and Dargan Watts pulled it out of mothballs and reposted it today. And,
Dargan Watts, wonder how he catalogs all these pictures. He's got a million pictures. So, how does he find them?
I don't know. But that was a picture I took in 1963 at Ramby Raceway, the black and gold number 3 of Russell Blackman. And I was thinking today after I saw that picture again, Bobby, I wonder if the reason it was a number 3 and it was black and gold was anything to do with the Smoky Unit cars. Goldsmith had a black and gold number 3, you know, those kind of things.
I always thought that the Junior Johnson team had that paint scheme too at that same. I thought he was sort of part of that group.
Yep. I remember that car used to sit at a gas station just before the bridge.
Yeah, on Irby Street.
Yeah, the little bridge goes down under the railroad tracks there on the right going into Florence.
I can't remember what kind of station it was.
I can't either. It might have been SO.
I want to say SO.
Yeah, me too, but I'm not positive.
But he went. But the car used to be there, and when I would see it, we would be going to Darlington to the race. That's how we would go. Was through right to the middle of Florence.
And like I was telling you earlier, when we were kind of talking about that, there was also a coupe at one point in number 3, painted the same way.
I only remember the sedan.
Yeah.
But now, how did you know that Russell Blackman was to be entered in the Southern 500?
It was a newspaper article I found, and I posted it on that same Facebook page today. It was basically saying about him being hurt, but then it said he was, let's see what the exact words were. Let me see if I can find that. It indicated that he had something to do with Darlington, because the last paragraph says the racer, talking about Russell Blackman, was to have participated in the Southern 500 at Darlington Labor Day. So, and that was September the 5th, 1963.
I remember, so that was 60. I remember the Russell Blackman. I don't remember the wreck, but I remember the aftermath when they drug the car out of the woods back onto the track, because evidently they didn't bother to get it until the race was over.
Yeah.
Just left her out there off the fourth turn.
I don't remember the wreck either, and I assume I was there that night. I'm not positive. But the whole thing, it was a short article that was in the Myrtle Beach paper, and it said, Russell Blackman, 36-year-old Florence resident, was hospitalized at Ocean View Memorial Hospital from injuries he received during the race at Ramby Raceway Saturday night. His condition is improving, according to Dr. Holmes B. Springs, attending physician. The racer was to have participated in the Southern 500 at Darlington Labor Day. So, I've always been curious as to that last paragraph.
Yeah, who would wonder who we have driven for and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So that the race at Ramby was on
Saturday
Labor Day.
Night. But on Saturday night, the race at Darlington would have been Labor Day on Monday.
I wasn't old enough to I remember the all of that, but I didn't remember it being Labor Day weekend.
Yeah.
We have Brother Densmore on the line.
Okay, cool.
Say hello, Cody.
Hello, Cody.
Hello, Cody.
How you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing pretty good. I hate that we, I wasted 20, 25 just trying to figure the Skype issue out, but it seems like I'm not the only one, so I don't.
No,
I feel too bad.
I'm seeing,
as much as I did, but
seeing several people say that they're having issues, and I know when I came back from being out of town, I came in here and checked on everything, and I turned on the computer I use for Skype, and it said you've been updated to the latest version of Skype, and that's and I've been, you know, I used it last night for Jerry and Bill and Patrick's shows then, but there may have been something happened today, because Patrick just now said on there that he couldn't get on either, and Alex came.
Well, my issue was, I never actually updated Skype for the last, I heard you say 9 years or something like it, so I decided to go ahead and update it, because it wouldn't even let me log in otherwise, so I updated it, and then it said it's not connected to the internet, or I have no internet connection, something like that, but right now I'm on the internet, so it's something weird with it.
Yeah, weird thing is it's showing Patrick online, but it's not connecting to him, but it showed you and Tim offline.
Windows did a major update today, too.
It's Tuesday.
Yep, a big update today.
Yep. Yep.
Now, could they go to Chrome and go in through?
Yeah,
it might try to start it up in Chrome.
Try Skype from a different browser. Yeah. There may be some sort of browser compatibility issue.
Exactly.
There. Could be. I don't know. I have a client that I've just built a website for, and I've been training the lady to use it. And she came in here, and we went through all kinds of stuff, used her computer and everything. Then she went back home, and she couldn't even get the website pages, the back end, to load. And she was on that new Windows 10 browser, whatever it is they got on there. I forget what you call it.
Edge.
And I said, open up Google Chrome. She said, I've been on this with this Edge before. I said, try Google Chrome. She opened up Google Chrome. Everything worked flawlessly in it. I mean, so here we are all these years after Al Gore invented the internet, and we're still having browser cross-compatibility issues.
Well, maybe he wasn't as smart as we thought he was.
Yeah,
maybe
you'd
planted something in there.
You'd think a man of his caliber could have come out of the box with compatible browser methods or something, you know? But anyway.
Patrick said he was on Chrome, so forget that theory.
Is Cody still there?
Cody's with us, yeah. He's on the phone here.
Cody. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah,
I'm just having to keep muting the microphone just in case something was to occur.
I'm not even going to ask.
Yeah, Cody, you probably saw the post earlier this week. Mike Bale put up a post about Leroy Yarborough.
I did. And I wanted to mention that
all the ever post one can read on Leroy Yarborough, no matter what it says or who wrote it, is an interesting read. That he is just
he was a character, wasn't he?
Yes. He was a character of all. You know, he was kind of epitomized early NASCAR, and maybe should again, but he definitely was a. He was a character.
Well, I tell you, I read the one that Mike posted on Facebook. I think it was written in 2008 or 2009. I think it was 2009, because they're talking about the anniversary of his Daytona 500 win. And I'll be honest, there's not a lot on Leroy Yarborough, just as much as you would know about maybe Allison or Pearson or Buddy Baker or anything like that. I mean, you can find information on that. But, for Leroy Yarborough, I just didn't really know a lot about him. So I enjoyed reading the first one. Then, Bob, you came back with that other article. I believe it was dated 1980.
Yeah, that
80 or 81 or something like that. But that was a very interesting article. I learned a lot from that one.
The two articles are, there's a lot of overlap there. The one that I put up, the writing style was so unique. I mean, it was so it added a lot of entertainment value, just the way that it was written. But yeah, I guess Cody, you obviously don't remember the Leroy era, but he was, man. In 1969, Leroy was NASCAR.
Yeah.
Him and driving the for Junior Johnson, there was nobody. I mean, he just, it was his year. It was kind of like.
Leroy would fight, too, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, little Bud had some Leroy stories.
Yeah, he had several. Yeah.
Now, didn't Leroy come, he come and raced at Ramby some?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Drove
Lewis Weatherby's car in Ramby in modified race a couple times.
He won his first Grand National race in the Louis Weatherby Plymouth at Savannah in 1963.
A lot of people don't realize that he had a brother that raced also, Eldon Yarborough. And Eldon was big in around the Jacksonville and South Georgia area.
Well, Leroy was extremely big in that area, yeah. But Leroy was obviously older than Eldon. Right. Leroy's time on the local level would have been the late 50s, early 60s. Way across Georgia and Speedway Park there in Jacksonville, he was virtually unbeatable at those places. Through reading all these things and comments and the singular comment that everybody keeps making from Junior Johnson to Richard Petty to just people that watched him at Jacksonville was he was fearless, according to them, according to those who saw it. And I think Richard Petty said that he knew one speed, and that was wide open.
Yeah, I back years ago, I was at a gas station we used to hang around at night in on Highway 17 in Myrtle Beach, and this car came whipping in one night. We were standing there, the guy rolled down the window. It was Leroy Yarborough. He said, "Can you tell me where the Princess Anne Hotel is?" Had some good-looking woman with him. I don't know if it's his wife or who it was, but they took off.
I was reading an article today about Bud Moore. Big Bud Moore and Leroy and Tiny Lund was in an airplane flying somewhere. There might have been some other people, but anyway, Leroy and Tiny, that was probably Leroy's closest friend. Another common description was he was pretty much a loner and didn't have a lot of friends. But him and Tiny was good friends, and they got to fighting in this airplane. They had to land much to everyone's relief so the fight could continue on the ground because Bud was scared it was going to cause the plane to crash. So what time they weren't fighting, they was just the best of friends. But Leroy grew up, I used to kind of feel like I knew Jacksonville, Florida, although I had never been there. Through the Big Ape,
WAPE,
and we've talked about that many times on this show. The Big Ape was just, man, it was bigger than life.
It sure was. Came in great in Myrtle Beach.
Yeah, it did. It was like the voice of the South almost. Yep. It was just a major presence. Damn, controlled everything.
Dino Summerman.
Somewhere. I can remember ads on the Big Ape for Jacksonville Speedway.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know where it was, but I remembered, and it was Jacksonville Speedway, be there. That's how they would end, and so that would have been in the Leroy era.
Yes,
and the Speedy Spears and all of them, and Jacksonville Speedway, which was also the place of the famous Wendell Scott victory. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Or the unvictory, you know, whatever it was. That was the same place. And it was on the west side of Jacksonville on Lenox Avenue and Plymouth Street. But there is a subdivision there on the old site now. But Leroy... And we've talked about this phenomena so many times. Leroy grew up on Plymouth Street, which was just within walking distance of the track. What in the world? Something is crashing my signal.
I thought I was going to have a Big Ape call, but I got something else going on.
So Leroy, he could walk to Jacksonville Speedway, to Speedway Park, and that had to be...
Yeah.
A factor in him becoming a race driver. When he was 12 years old, put a big Chrysler motor in a 34 Ford coupe, and basically his course was set.
For all the people out there trying to get on Skype, Skype has support has tweeted, "We're working on resolving an issue affecting login services. We apologize for the inconvenience." That was 3 hours ago on Twitter.
So, well, I guess they're still working on it.
So I guess if your Skype wasn't up and you had to log in, you got an issue. I never log out. You know, I mean, I don't right. see the need for it, because I was told early on that Skype, the whole system, depends on people being logged in to relay itself. So I always load Skype and never log out. So I guess that's why I have it, and these people that are trying to log in don't.
The Big Rodeo. That's us.
Yeah. Is that the Big Eight?
That's Big Eight.
Is that modern Big Eight?
No, that's not.
Back
that's
in the
1965.
Is it really? That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, pretty.
I was hoping we'd get a Big Ape call in.
That's it.
Oh,
that's it. That's
the
it.
Big Ape.
That's the Big Ape.
That's Jackson, cool.
Yeah, that sounds just like it.
Yeah, it was
yeah,
it.
Sounds exactly like it. Well, Leroy Yarbrough, getting back to Plymouth Street where he lived, it was a dirt road in it, and there was a guy in the neighborhood named Tommy Moon who had a garage, and that's where they all, that was the racing headquarters. And among the kids that hung out at Tommy Moon's garage because they liked Leroy was Ronnie Van Zant.
Really?
Yep. The Ronnie Van Zant.
Wow.
Hung out. He was from the same neighborhood, and he said, "I'm going to be as famous, I'm going to be the next most famous person to come out of Jacksonville since Leroy Yarbrough."
Huh.
And he was.
And he was. Yeah. But he thought, he saw himself as becoming a race driver.
Huh.
Him and his friends, they had seats they had nailed in the tops of pine trees out at Jacksonville Speedway that they watched, you know, climb a tree and the classic sitting in trees phenomena. And Leroy was their hero, and it was Ronnie Van Zant.
That's a story I'd never heard before.
Yeah, he was from the same.
After all these years.
The same. It was a blue-collar, you know,
yep,
low echelon part of perfect racetrack material. And that's where he came. And no doubt that the Big Ape was an influence on the Van Zants also.
Probably. Must. Big Ape was huge. I mean, it was.
Well, he just, on that ad, it said he went to Washington, D.C.
Yeah. I mean, everybody in the southeast, on the coast.
Every radio I had, though, it would quit at Wilmington.
It would also quit about dark, because
yeah,
they were they would cut the power from, what it was, 50,000 watts to
5,000
5,000 yeah, or something at dark, because the FCC. But you could pick them up crystal clear in Myrtle Beach.
Huh. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And whatever the weather was in Jacksonville, you could just subtract or just adjust the temperature by, yeah, 5 or 6 yeah, degrees, and the rest of it would be the same. The Jacksonville weather worked for us. It's the same weather.
They had a, if I remember correctly, and I may be wrong about this, but they had a big, like a swimming pool in front of the studio. It was really a cooling facility for the air conditioner. The people would come there and jump in the pool.
The Big Ape was very involved in getting the Beatles to the Gator Bowl in 1964. I don't know if they might have been the main, but the Beatles, man, that was the biggest thing in the world in 1964, and they got them in the Gator. They had this big contest, Beatles in the Gator Bowl. I can hear it now.
And they,
you could win tickets and stuff.
Big Ape had a sister station in Birmingham called WBAM, which was their
that.
Sister station, yeah.
I did not know that.
So.
Well, you know, getting finish up Leroy, he just, the big mystery is what happened to him, and that
yeah,
remains a mystery. It is a very sad story, and one of the, Cody mentioned that you just can't find much Leroy stuff like you can some other, and that's one of the reasons is the Leroy's story does not really have a happy ending for all the tremendous success that he was Ford Racing Man of the Year in 1969. He was, you know, he was on the sports car team. He, you know, raced at Indy and everything. He was.
He lived in Columbia, South Carolina for a while.
Yeah, bought a mansion out on Lake Murray. Yeah, he was. He had it going on, and the official reason is he got Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Yeah. But the more you dig into the story, the less credible that theory actually is. Almost nobody that knows Leroy believes that.
Well, he also had a drug problem.
Big Bud Moore says. Racing happened. The leader, he just ran into too many cement walls.
Yeah.
You know, it just sadly just affected him. First big crash was at Texas World Speedway in 1970. And then that was followed by another severe crash at Indy in 71. He was driving for Dan Gurney, practice crash, and that really put him, kind of put him over the edge. His last race was in 1972. In Nashville, the Nashville 400, driving for Bill Seifert, and he didn't run any races. I mean, he didn't make any laps. He went around on the pace lap, pulled into the garage, got out of the car, and the official reason for leaving the race was quit. Just quit.
Huh.
Never came back. He did. He showed up at Daytona in 1973 for Speed Weeks, but with nobody. You know, nobody would.
Well, that career went downhill quickly when you think about it, didn't it?
Real quick.
Yeah. From 69 to 73.
He was gone. Actually, after 69.
Yeah.
It was basically. So a sad story.
Yep.
So
either you boys have anything you want to contribute tonight?
Well, we can do the Carolina race place. Historic race finish if you want.
Let's do it.
Or we can do something else. Doesn't matter.
It's whatever. Yeah.
Well, I can do it.
Where are we going tonight?
We're going to one of our favorite tracks in Virginia.
Sobo.
Martinsville. The 8th annual Cardinal 500 races were held at the half-mile paved Martinsville Speedway on Sunday, October 26, 1975. The split event consisted of a 250 laps of racing for the late model sportsman cars and 250 laps of racing for the modified cars. Jeff Bodine won the modified race, but tonight we're going to look at the late model sportsman event. Time trials for the top starting positions in the 40-car field were held on Friday. Butch Lindley of Greenville, South Carolina won the pole position driving a Nova in time trials. He also set a new late model sportsman track record with a speed of 86.353 miles per hour. The four fastest qualifiers were all driving Novas. Four 25-lap late model sportsman races, heat races, were qualifying races actually, were held on Saturday to fill the remaining starting spots. When the late model sportsman race got started on Sunday, it was under a very dark, overcast sky. Butch Lindley led the first lap. On lap two, Jack Bland hit the front stretch wall, bringing out the first of 14 caution flags of the race. Getting caught up in the accident was Johnny Allen and Andre Manny. All three drivers were done for the day. Harry Gant hit the wall on lap 18, making his steering unrepairable. Two laps later, Joe Frisson's Nova retired to the pits with engine problems. Frisson was the only one of four Grand National drivers entered to qualify. Jack Ingram was running second place behind Lindley when his engine failed on lap 68. On lap 97, Butch Lindley was still holding down the lead when Red Cagle's engine exploded, bringing out another caution period. Lindley took this opportunity to make a pit stop. Tommy Houston became the new leader. Houston held the lead until a caution flag on lap 124 when Ray Hendrick's engine blew. At that point, Lindley regained the lead, followed by Tommy Houston, Sonny Hutchins, Monk Tate, and Don Meller. Blown engines on lap 167 and 185 continued to bring out caution periods. Houston and Hutchison were done for the day. By lap 180, Butch Lindley had lapped every car in the field. Monk Tate was in second place one lap down. The sun began to set around lap 200 as darkness began to come over the track. Butch Lindley's radio went out, so he lost communications with his crew. He ran over something on the track, causing his right front tire to lose air. He finally came into the pits for a tire change on lap 242, catching his crew off guard. Monk Tate took over the lead in just about full darkness and held it for the final eight laps. Tate, driving the Thomas Brothers Nova with a Jack Tant engine, won the biggest race of his career. Tate won $5,400 for the victory before 20,000 fans in attendance.
Wow.
So here's the way they finished. Sunday, October 26, 1975, the late model sportsman half of the Cardinal 500. The winner, who started in the 11th position, driving the number 88, Monk Tate of Ruffin, North Carolina, and a Nova, followed by the number 00 of Bill Dennis from Glen Allen, Virginia, in a Chevelle. Butch Lindley, Greenville, South Carolina, in a Nova. Jimmy Hensley, Martinsville, Virginia, Chevelle. Red Foote, Southington, Connecticut, in a Chevelle. Jimmy Griffin, Eden, North Carolina, in a Pontiac Ventura. Bradley Teague, Johnson City, Tennessee, in a Chevelle. Bosco Lowe, Fletcher, North Carolina, Chevelle. Lester Gupton, Hampton, Virginia, in a Chevelle. Joe Thurman, Rocky Mount, Virginia, in a Chevelle, finished 10th, followed by Don Miller, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Chevelle. Darrell Bryant, Thomasville, North Carolina, Chevelle. Hank Thomas, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Chevelle. Coming in 14th, the name we've talked about a little bit, Dale Earnhardt, Kannapolis, North Carolina, a Nova. Dave Dion, Hudson, New Hampshire, in a Torino. Junior Crouch, Taylorsville, North Carolina, in a Cougar. Reds Cagle, Landham, Maryland, in a Chevelle. Sonny Hutchinson, Richmond, Virginia, Ventura. Tommy Houston, Conover, North Carolina, a Nova. Ed Howe, Beaverton, Michigan, in a Nova, was 20th. Joe Falk, Chesapeake, Virginia, Chevelle. Bruce Warren, Norfolk, Virginia, Chevelle. Ken Fogerman, Durham, North Carolina, Chevelle. Ray Hendrick, Richmond, Virginia, a Nova, coming in 25th. Morgan Shepherd, Conover, North Carolina, in a Chevelle. Jimmy Todd, Manassas, Virginia, Chevelle. L.D. Ottinger, Newport, Tennessee, a Chevelle. Landis Camp Carden, Quebec City, Canada, in a Chevelle. John Linville, Kernersville, North Carolina, Chevelle. Coming in 30th, Jack Ingram, Asheville, North Carolina, Chevelle. Coming in 31st, Bobby Junior Johnson, Florence, South Carolina.
Just saw Chevelle. That number three. What is that with that?
I don't know. Roy Hendrick, Richmond, Virginia, Chevelle. Bobby Ballantyne, Baltimore, Maryland, Chevelle. Harry Gant, Taylorsville, North Carolina, a Nova. Coming in 35th, Joe Frisson, Golden Valley, Minnesota, a Nova. Bobby Fleming, Danville, Virginia, a Nova. Paul Radford, Furham, Virginia, a Chevelle. Andre Manny, Montreal, Canada, a Chevelle. Jack Bland, Riverdale, Maryland, a Chevelle. In the 40th and final car, Mr. Johnny Allen, Greenville, South Carolina, driving a Chevelle.
What year was that?
1975.
75. So what year were all those Chevelles, you think?
Oh, they were probably...
The newest one would have been a 68 or 9.
Yeah, yes, probably 69. That was probably the car of choice for Chevelle.
What was
this was the big change to Novas and the Venturas and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chevelles were sort of played by that point once the Nova.
Yeah, they didn't. I couldn't get any years of the cars, which, you know.
A lot of them were 68, 69. Yeah,
but the Chevelle had the full frame. The Nova didn't, did it, when it came out?
I don't think it did.
Didn't it come out with a unibody
type of
frame? So they probably.
The early ones definitely did. The little Chevy 2s never had frames. They just had a subframe. A
lot of Novas. And
You know, that's 1975. Sam Ard was definitely driving the Thomas Brothers car that summer.
Well, so, Thomas Brothers had two cars in this race. Monk Tate was in one. Ray Hendrick was in the other.
I know. And curiously, Sam Ard was not in either one of them.
Exactly.
That was my point. Something had went haywire between the normal racing season and, of course, this was October 26th, about this time of year. They would get back together, but they had moments of, you know, on again, off again, and this is one of them.
But I'm with you about the Junior Johnson from our local area from Florence in a number three.
Remember, Martinsville for many years had a history of those stick-on numbers,
exactly.
Those big white stickers with black numbers on them.
Yep,
it could have been something like that.
Yeah, because Reds Cagle was driving a number one, and around that time he drove number one a lot.
Yeah, and he might have been pre-registered earlier than Junior or something like that.
Yeah.
That would be my guess. It was one of them stick-on, one of them big white stickers with a black number.
Yep.
Cool stuff.
That Martinsville always had. Why, you know, that was a bet. Those twin modified late model sports was almost as big of attractions as the Grand Nationals was back in the day.
And the news reports that I was looking at, they were kind of disappointed this year because they only had 60 entries for the late model sportsman race. Down from about 120 the previous year.
And 20,000 fans.
And 20,000 fans.
In 1975, that was a good
crowd. They were also making comments about only 20,000 fans because the weather was so bad. It was rainy on and off all week. And this race actually ended in the dark and no lights.
Seemed like I remember Monk Tate briefly driving. He's a vintage racer now sometime.
But he didn't drive a whole lot of NASCAR races. He mostly drove independent tracks.
He was from that Orange County area, around in that area.
Cody, did you know all that?
No, I didn't.
Your continuing education.
We need to educate Cody on a few more things. Of course, I think he educates us on more than we do him.
It's been a two-way street for nearly 10 years. Yeah. You know?
But those events was huge. Those double headers at Martinsville. They had the Cardinal in the spring, it was the Dogwood in the spring, wasn't it?
Yeah, Dogwood in the spring, the Cardinal in the fall.
In the fall, they were just. And I don't know exactly. Do you know roughly when they just ceased to exist?
I don't. This was the 8th annual Cardinal 500.
And it was in 75.
In 75.
They went on for a few more years.
I would say they did, yeah.
And I don't exactly know what happened to, you know, that they ceased, because that seemed like a solid performance there for the track. They've got this late model stock thing that they do now in the fall, but that's, I guess that's the closest thing they've got now to something like that.
And that's been going on for a long time, man.
A long time, yeah.
I mean, I remember back in the, golly, 80s, that was still, I mean, that, I don't know how long it had been going on then, but I'm trying to think, mid-80s probably. I think the first time I heard about it, or maybe late 80s. But it's been going on before that.
If it was mid-80s, that would have been 18 years.
Yeah.
Well, I guess maybe when the late model sportsman ceased to be that.
When Bush came on the scene.
When Bush, and they really moved it to a companion Winston Cup thing, that probably was the beginning of the end for the Martinsville thing.
Hey, check your math again.
What is that? If this was the 8th and 10 years later it would have been 85, that would have been 18 years.
That ran. I thought you meant years ago.
Because
I'm trying to think. But anyway, it hurts when I do that.
Ken Fogelman. Is that Jay Fogelman's father? Or?
They're from that same area.
Yeah, from Durham.
It's got to be some of that.
Yeah.
That same family.
Kent Fogelman.
Yeah.
Anyway, we continue to document this late model sportsman racing.
So the same on that same day was the modified race.
Yes. Too. Yeah. Jeff Bodine won the modified.
Yeah, that's when he was coming on strong with that number one. Or it might have been the 99. I'm not. The Valiant.
I didn't spend a whole lot of time looking at the modified part of it. So.
Did you ever go to any, I got a chance to go to one of them one time and didn't do it until I never saw one of those races.
I did not go to one of these. I did go to Martinsville a couple of times, but it was not for this.
Yep.
I did see a modified race in Martinsville one time, actually, before a Grand National, probably, I don't know, in the 80s. Probably in the 90s, actually, early 90s.
All right. Cool stuff.
Hey, we're always cool.
Yeah, we're the coolest. We've been cool before it was cool to be cool.
Oh, yeah. We've been cold, too.
Yeah. So, Cody, is it fall in Dawsonville yet?
Yeah, we got our first taste of it this week. So, it's starting to cool on down, but, you know, we're getting ready for the Moonshine Festival.
Yeah, that's coming right up.
When is that?
Next week?
Let's see. Not this Saturday, but the next day.
Week from
it's
Saturday?
The 50th year of it.
50 years, man.
Wow.
Man.
And that event gets bigger every year.
It sure does. You know, it's a shame because the bigger it gets, it's like the more the race drivers that we always get to come around and the car owners just, you know, start, you know, there's less and less every year, but it's still a bigger event than it was, you know.
Yep. Well, maybe y'all can get Chase Elliott to come.
Well, I think they're racing in Marble that weekend, now that you mention it. But, you know, regardless, I'm sure we'll see somebody there. But, you know, it'll be a good time for sure. We've got Jody Ridley as the Grand Marshal this year.
Oh, that's cool.
So we're looking forward to him getting a lot of recognition. So I'm sure we'll be in a lot of Falcons. I know about two or three in existence, one real and two or three replicas. In fact, Jody, last year, year before, he built himself a street legal replica of his 64 Falcon.
Wow.
So he drives that thing around the road and takes it around to shows and everything. So that's pretty cool. So I'm sure we'll see it. And there's a couple others around that I've seen before.
Yeah, that's very cool. So, golly, I can't even get it out. Over the past few years, when I first started going down there, most of the crowd was up on the hill, up on the main part of town, and it had just started growing down around the museum. How's that shift? Has that changed any at all, or Cody?
Oh, yeah. In fact, most of it is down at the museum and really all around now. They cut out half of the town area, and more of the cars are down towards the museum and the parking lots down there and the field behind the museum and down all the side roads. I mean, there's no way possible to look at every single car that's there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so many show cars. My favorite thing is it's not just your normal run-of-the-mill show cars. I mean, there's nothing against them, but 57 Chevys and your 69 Camaros and your 65 Mustangs and the like. I mean, there's anything that's there is going to be kind of odd.
Well, more 40 Fords than you'll ever see anywhere.
Definitely. A lot of the moonshine era and prohibition cars and all that fun stuff.
That's cool. Well, folks, we're going to get on out of here. Cody, thanks for connecting with us, buddy. Hope we have better luck next week on the Skype.
well, I appreciate it.
I'm going to be here two more weeks. Let's see, 3 weeks. I'm not sure.
Tim's Skype just came up.
Did it? I'll be leaving the 16th, I think, of November. I'll be gone a couple weeks. So we're going to miss a couple more shows or so.
But we got two more before that happens.
I think so, yeah. Okay. Yeah, whatever that works
two
out.
Two or three. We'll figure it out,
yeah, we'll be here till then anyway. So, all right, thanks. Appreciate all you guys helping put this thing together. Thanks for the fans that hung in there. Sorry that Skype dumped on us. But as always, we want to say a special thanks to the men and women that serve our military. Thank you for doing what you do so that we can do this. Each and every one of you, good night, and God bless.